This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. Welcome to the Trumpet Hour Week in Review. We're doing something a little different than usual this week. Our panel of trumpet writers is traveling, so rather than doing a regular review of this past week's events, we're taking a look back over this past year, replaying some of the most important segments that we've featured in something of a year in review. This is part two of this project. We aired the first part last week. You can go back and listen to that on thetrumpet.com if you haven't yet. Here again, you will hear from each of our regular panelists selections of what they believe to be the most critical events and trends in their respective regions from this past year. We're following a rough chronological flow, and we'll start today with this story from this past March when Vladimir Putin claimed that Russia now has nuclear weapons that are unstoppable. This was discussed on our March 2nd, 2018 program by Jeremiah Jacques.
And then he said that Russia has recently tested some very advanced new nuclear weapons, including a nuclear-powered cruise missile and a nuclear-capable underwater drone that he said are basically impossible to intercept. And this was a multimedia presentation, so he was using all these colorful graphics and videos to demonstrate what these weapons are capable of. At one point, he was talking about these hypersonic, supposedly unstoppable missiles. And there was actually a video playing in the background that showed multiple nuclear warheads streaking through space and then showering down on what looked like the outline of the state of Florida. So that's just indescribably provocative, really, to show that sort of thing while you're talking about these weapons. And then right around that point, Vladimir Putin said, quote, "They need to take account of a new reality and understand this is not a bluff." And Putin said that the reason why Russia's been upgrading its nuclear arsenal was because the United States withdrew from the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty back in the year 2002. After that withdrawal, Russia warned the world that it would have to kind of respond by upgrading its own nuclear arsenals. But he said no one wanted to talk to Russia at that time. And then he said, quote, "No one listened to us then, so listen to us now." And at that point, if you watch this video, it's amazing to see just the thunderous applause that broke out in this venue where he was delivering the speech. The people of Russia love this kind of display of strength. They love to see Putin standing up to the United States and to the West. But the truth is that whether America had left that missile treaty or not, Putin has been determined to really make Russia great again since the very beginning of his rule back in 1999. And he even said back in 2005 that the collapse of the Soviet Union was the greatest catastrophe of the 20th century. And he's been working to rebuild the Russian Empire ever since then. We saw that in 2008 when Russia invaded Georgia and it placed some parts of Georgia under Moscow's control. We saw it again in 2014 when Russia annexed Ukraine's Crimean Peninsula. And now Putin's focus on upgrading Russia's nuclear arsenals is, you know, it's really motivated by that same broader goal of just expanding Russia's power, restoring its place on the global stage, and just being able to stand up to the West and make Russia be seen by the world as a nation to be feared. So it's a really important story. And Putin mentioned the U.S. in his address, but Bible prophecy tells us that the real region to watch in terms of how it will respond to Russia's increasing aggression is Europe. Back in 2014, shortly after Russia had annexed Crimea, Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury explained the significance of that move for Europe in terms of Bible prophecy. And Mr. Fleury wrote, quote, "We've been prophesying for around 70 years that Eastern Europe would become a vital part of a new European superpower, a resurrection of the Holy Roman Empire. This prophecy is directly related to the Crimean crisis. The fear you see in Europe because of events in Crimea is going to cause 10 leaders in Europe to unite in a sudden and dramatic way and in precise accordance with the Bible's description of that European empire. Europe's new fear of Russia is going to play a major role in hastening the fulfillment of that prophecy. End quote. So that's just a really powerful analysis by Mr. Fleury there, just showing that the Europeans are fearful of Russia and how much that plays into what Andrew is talking about with the Holy Roman Empire being unified. The Europeans have not forgotten what happened in Georgia and in Ukraine, and now they see Russia's increasingly belligerent posturing with its nuclear weapons. And the fear of Russia that's now intensifying among many Europeans is making the Europeans want to become more unified politically and militarily, because they know that within a unified European bloc, they stand a far better chance of being able to stand up to this rising Russian threat.
Right. I think especially in Eastern Europe, that's even more prevalent. You'll see, I mean, Finland, the Baltic states, Poland, Ukraine, Bulgaria, even the Czech Republic. These are nations that have been behind the Iron Curtain before, remember what it's like, and are really worried when they see Putin talk about the collapse of the Soviet Union being the greatest geopolitical catastrophe of the 20th century. I know it was back during the earlier times of the Obama administration where he'd nixed a U.S. missile defense shield that they were wanting to put into the area where it was either the president or the prime minister, I think it was the prime minister of the Czech Republic at the time, summarized things fairly poetically when he was talking about how America had abandoned them and they needed to sign this Lisbon Treaty to get into the European Union, because he said it was better to kiss the German chancellor than hug the Russian bear.
You really do see in these smaller nations that they know that they stand no chance of standing up to Russian aggression on their own. And so there is quite a lot of impetus for the countries in Eastern Europe to throw their support behind Germany. They want Germany to become stronger, and they're willing to put all of their might kind of behind Berlin.
One of the most stunning stories that has unfolded over this past year has been the rancorous warfare between the White House and what is being referred to as the deep state, agencies like the Justice Department and the FBI. We've covered this story quite a lot over the past year, but perhaps the best single example of it was on not a Week in Review episode, but one of our Wednesday Trumpet Hour programs, our April 11th edition, in this report by Andrew Miller.
It's no exaggeration to say that United States President Donald Trump is at war with his own spies. In the past, federal intelligence agencies and the White House generally formed a united front. But now it has been revealed that the Department of Justice cooperated with the Federal Bureau of Investigation to spy on the Trump presidential campaign in 2016. These agencies fraudulently used an unverified dossier paid for by the Hillary Clinton campaign to obtain a secret court order to wiretap President Trump's inner circle. This has led to a deep rift between the Trump administration and the U.S. intelligence community. President Trump is working to expose corruption in the FBI and the rest of the intelligence community. Last November, he denounced former Director of Central Intelligence John Brennan and former Director of National Intelligence James Clapper as political hacks. Now, many journalists and media figures have rallied to defend America's spies from President Trump. Yet there is a great danger in overlooking the serious charges Trump and others have made against the intelligence community. We are witnessing the growth of a surveillance state with powers even George Orwell couldn't have imagined. In the 1970s, Senator Frank Church led an investigation into illegal CIA, FBI, and NSA intelligence gathering activities. And on NBC's Meet the Press, he issued this warning. If this government ever becomes a tyranny, if a dictator ever took charge in this country, the technological capacity that the intelligence community has given the government could enable it to impose a total tyranny. And there would be no way to fight back, because the most careful efforts to combine together in resistance to the government, no matter how privately it was done, is within the reach of the government to know. These technological capacities that Senator Church warned about grew much stronger during the presidencies of George W. Bush and Barack Obama. Now, President Bush signed an executive order in 2002 authorizing the NSA to eavesdrop on U.S. citizens and foreign nationals if the government suspected that they had ties to terrorists. Even though President Obama promised to curb this type of data collection, he ended up greatly expanding the powers of the American surveillance state instead. James Banford writes in The New Republic, assuming that past norms would be future norms, Obama created the most powerful surveillance state the world has ever seen. Over 8 years, he spent more than $100 billion on everything from eavesdropping satellites encircling the globe to a million-square-foot building in the Utah desert for storing massive troves of intercepted data, to secret taps on hundreds of thousands of miles of undersea cables that carry everything from tweets to Google searches to endless chatter. He also unleashed fleets of killer drones around the world, authorized the assassinations of Americans without trial, and jailed more whistleblowers than all previous presidents combined. And now it's been revealed that President Obama called a meeting of key officials from the U.S. intelligence community on January 5th, 2017. These officials discussed how the investigation of the Trump campaign could continue after Mr. Trump was sworn in as president. Now, if these officials could have successfully kept Donald Trump out of office, they would have overturned the results of a Democratic election and effectively staged a deep state coup. This would have ultimately meant the end of America's constitutional system of government. If government spies can use unverified rumors to keep a political candidate they don't like out of office, we are no longer living in a democratic republic. We're living in an authoritarian technocracy. Now, these are facts that are being glossed over by journalists that jump to defend the FBI from President Trump. Article 2 of the U.S. Constitution makes the president the chief of the executive branch. And so what happens when elements of the executive branch go rogue and start fighting against their boss? The best case scenario is political gridlock. The worst case scenario is civil war. In the past, in other nations like Turkey or Egypt, the people have actually risen up against the government when the intelligence community has tried to overturn the results of a democratic election. The rifts between the Trump administration and the intelligence community are far more serious than most people realize. The president is at war with the most powerful surveillance state to ever exist, and things stand to get messy. More and more Americans need to realize that their government is sick and their nation is faint. And there is a spiritual reason for this. The prophet Isaiah wrote in Isaiah chapter 1, verses 4 through 5, "Ah, sinful nation, a people laden with iniquity, a seed of evildoers, children that are corruptors, they have forsaken the Lord. They have provoked the Holy One of Israel unto anger, and they are gone away backward. Why should you be stricken any more? You will revolt more and more. The whole head is sick, and the whole heart is faint." Now, the Trump administration is trying to fight against some of these nefarious activities done by the deep state. But the more it tries to do this, the more divided America becomes. And this is because America's problems are not actually the result of one man or even a small group of men. They are the results of the sins of the American people as a whole. And only national repentance can bring the entire nation to a point where God can fix America's dangerous divisions.
In May, a major story was America moving its embassy in Israel to Jerusalem, representing America's recognition of Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. This was part of somewhat of a resurgence in Israel's standing in the world recently, and we talked about the significance of it on our May 16th program with Brent Noctegal.
In Israel, it's been quite a positive event. You could even sense that if you watched the broadcast, the live broadcast. It just took place about a mile and a half away from where I am right now, so very close, right on the border between West and East Jerusalem, but still technically in West Jerusalem, where the consulate is, that is now the embassy. And just the feeling of adulation that this is finally something that is taking place correcting a wrong. All of Israel looks at Jerusalem as their capital, whether they're religious or not. It's a no-brainer for them. And so for the United States to finally come along and say, yeah, we deem this to be the capital of your nation as well, was really encouraging for Israel, because obviously Israel has a lot of enemies. We're even seeing that today in the aftermath of the events that took place on the Gaza border. And even on Tuesday afternoon, the UN Security Council sat down to have a meeting about that. So you can see a lot of the opposite perspective saying that this embassy move really did cause unnecessary deaths of Palestinians in the Gaza Strip and the West Bank, when Israelis don't see it as that. They see them as disconnected issues completely. This was just basically the United States catching up on what is already believed to be true amongst Israelis.
I definitely want to talk about the Palestinian response and the violence that has happened. But just to remain focused on the declaration of the embassy move itself for a bit longer, it was really interesting how much of a religious tone all of those proceedings in the ceremony had.
Yeah, I was surprised by that completely, actually, watching it. It was bookended by two prayers. A pastor of a Baptist church and another one at the end, I believe, from the United States, popular religious figures. And these prayers that they gave in front of a largely Israeli audience, a largely Jewish audience, and it was very surprising to me. I would just like to quote a little bit from an article. This is from the Times of Israel yesterday. It's by Raphael Aaron. And he talks about how jubilant everybody was. But then he focuses on how that these prayers given by these two men from the United States basically overstated the fact that, well, basically they said that David, or he said that kind of King David, the founder of Jerusalem as the state of capital of the state of Israel, fell into the background. And we had Trump taking on this messianic type role here. This is what he said. He said, speaker after speaker hailed his recent decisions. This is speaking of Trump, to recognize Jerusalem as Israel's capital and to withdraw from the Iran nuclear deal, describing Trump as a modern day messiah who courageously stands up for the truth where lies have long prevailed, a leader of historic stature who protects the national interests of the U.S. And Israel like no one before him. And so then these pastors got up and gave these prayers saying, we want to thank you, God, for the tremendous leadership of our great president. Without President Trump's determination, resolve, and courage, we would not be here today. And I believe I speak for every one of us when I say I thank you every day that you have given us a president who boldly stands on the right side of history, but more importantly, stands on the right side of you, oh God, when it comes to Israel. So this is right at the beginning of this declaration, and you have this pastor getting up there saying that Mr. Trump is acting on behalf of God right now, and this is obvious to him. And then at the end, you kind of had that same type of speech. This was from Pastor John Hagee. This was at the end of it. He said, we thank you, O Lord, for President Donald Trump's courage in acknowledging to the world a truth established 3,000 years ago, that Jerusalem is and always shall be the internal capital of the Jewish people. And then he said, can I get a hallelujah? And everyone in the audience said a hallelujah. And that might not sound weird for an American audience, but living in Israel for on and off for about a decade now, in the last 2 years straight, for a Jewish audience, they haven't really seen much of that before.
That's really interesting.
And so they were exposed to that. But that was just surprising to me that they would have these pastors would, and the American led delegation would feel completely comfortable voicing those prayers in the name of Jesus Christ, the Messiah, in front of these Jewish people. But that said, we know that the evangelical support for the state of Israel probably even trumps the support of Israelis for the state of Israel. Mm-hmm. That's the running joke over here. But when we saw that on full display at this opening ceremony.
Yeah, very, very interesting in light of that opening chapter in Gerald Flory's booklet, Great Again, where he talks about that religious connection between Donald Trump and the evangelicals in the United States, and how there are prophetic echoes in that relationship. So looking at Israel and Benjamin Netanyahu receiving this kind of support, not only from the United States, but quite a few other nations as well that seem to be following America's lead in at least showing their support for this move. I guess there are a few nations already that are talking about moving their embassies there as well. But in the meantime, Netanyahu is also enjoying, say, the Donald Trump pulling out of the Iran deal, a certain amount of resurgence in his own leadership. And it looks like, you know, Israel is enjoying somewhat of a resurgence nationally. Stephen Fleury has been bringing this out on the Trumpet Daily Radio Show, just how when you view this in light of what Gerald Fleury has been saying about this God saving Israel temporarily through this American president, it is interesting to view what's happening in Israel in that context.
For sure. And I think, you know, those comments about Mr. Trump really revitalizing the United States for a time and God using him to give it a boost. We do see that the knock-on effects with that, with his relationship with Israel. If you talk about him pulling out of the Iran deal, being hand in hand with Israel in that, then this decision as well. You look at even the State Department, how they came out and said about the attacks on the Gaza border, that Hamas, we deem Hamas fully responsible for those deaths.
Yeah.
That took place. I think it's the United States and Australia, the only ones that have come out favorable in that instance. And so you do see Mr. Netanyahu and Israel as a whole feeling jubilant right now. They have the capital being recognized. You even had the winner of Eurovision being an Israeli, which means the Eurovision Song Contest is going to come to Israel, which is, again, outside an American audience, European audience. This thing is massive, Eurovision, and that's going to bring even more attention to Israel in the future. And so, yeah, times are good. Times are good for the Israeli state, as far as they see it, as well as the leadership of Mr. Netanyahu. You even had some commentators coming out and saying that he is the greatest statesman in Israel's history. And while that may be the case, you don't hear people normally, Israeli commentators, talking about their own current leaders in that way. Normally they have to be dead or wait a few decades before they'll do that thing, that type of thing.
It has caused the accusations of corruption that had been dogging Netanyahu. You haven't been hearing about those either. So just in the interest of looking at the bigger picture here, you actually posted I guess it was a social media post that you put or it was on the Watch Jerusalem website, an excerpt from Daniel Pipes, where he was talking about Donald Trump, his recognizing Jerusalem as Israel's capital, possibly being part of a larger strategy that might not work in Israel's interest in the long run. Can you explain about that?
Yeah, so even looking into Bible prophecy, we can see from specific prophecy in Zechariah chapter 11 that there is going to be a break between the United States and Israel. And we don't see that. In fact, we see the complete opposite right now. Back during President Obama's time, we could say, well, that was happening, obviously. And really, the damage from that, it still does exist, and yet the relationship is really good now. Well, Daniel Pipes comes out and says that, well, this move by Mr. Trump, we shouldn't, you know, be too giddy about this, because there might be some follow-up steps that take place where we might see him ask Israelis things that they wouldn't be willing to give up or aren't willing to give up in search of a negotiated peace with the Palestinians. That, of course, hasn't left his mind. You had Jason Greenblatt and Jared Kushner, both of them there at the opening of the embassy. They're the ones that are charged by Mr. Trump at bringing peace between the Palestinians and the Israelis. So maybe there is something else on the cards. This is what Daniel Pipes wrote. He said this, turning to the Middle East, Trump has two grand priorities: reducing the Iranian threat and accomplishing the ultimate deal of bringing an end to the Arab-Israeli conflict. The two goals are related because the only way to build a powerful alliance against Iran is by including Israel. That in turn means resolving the Palestinian issue. And so he says he's got a couple of steps that Trump's doing. Step one for this, give the Saudi leadership what it wants so that they can come on board to be the anti-Iranian alliance. Step two, do the same for Israel. Give it what it longs for, a U.S. embassy in Jerusalem. And then he says step three, do the same thing for the Palestinians. Palestine with a capital also in Jerusalem. That is what he expects. And there has been discussions that have been leaked that there might be another announcement soon that says that East parts of East Jerusalem, maybe not everything that they want, but at least parts of East Jerusalem, that Trump is willing to call that the future capital of the Palestinian state. So Daniel Pipes has received a lot of flack over this, over his tweet saying, hey, don't get too excited about this. This could backfire in Israel. There's no free lunch when it comes to these things from the American president. Mm-hmm. And we could see that, which in the very near future, Mr. Trump doing something similar for the Palestinians.
A major example of the political turmoil going on in Europe happened in Italy this past year. Inconclusive elections meant that it took the country ages to get a government. On our June 1st program, we talked about this just as Italy installed its new prime minister, and then Spain lost its prime minister. This story was brought by Richard Palmer.
Yes, it's been a bit of a roller coaster week. I mean, it's been a bit of a roller coaster these last couple of weeks, at least for Italy. It kind of feels like we're having to do updates on that on a weekly basis. The good news is, if you're fed up of hearing about Italy, they have their prime minister now. Finally, he was sworn in today. It's a done deal. I think normally I'm here talking about what seems to be about to happen.
Yeah,
he's in now. They've got Giuseppe Conte. He was sworn in. So to kind of recap, he was about to be sworn in last week. And then the president stepped in and said no. He said that he objected to the finance minister, Paola Savona. Savona was too Eurosceptic for Italy's prime minister. Savona, he's called the Euro Germany's cage. He said that Germany didn't change its ideas on its role in Europe at the end of Nazism, even if it abandoned the idea of imposing itself militarily. So he's very anti. He talked about getting a plan B ready to get Italy out of the euro. And the president stepped in and said, no, that's an unacceptable view for a finance minister to hold. That leaving the euro could, in his opinion, prove catastrophic to Italian savings. That's not allowed.
Which is quite an extraordinary development for the president to basically say, we have to make sure that we're not riling Germany up in this process.
Right. I mean, he's essentially he's in a constitutional gray area. He does have the power to block appointments, but generally it's because of objections to the individual. Every other time it's been used, like, this individual has a conflict of interest. This individual lacks the background or the ability to do the job. This is the first time that the prime minister has ever said this belief mm-hmm. is outlaw.
Right.
And that power doesn't exist to block beliefs. The president, he wasn't even democratically elected. He was kind of put in through a backroom dealing between political parties. And so this is unprecedented. People have called it a soft coup or a quiet coup. They've said it's a constitutional gray area. And you look at his argument and why is objecting to the euro dangerous for Italians or potentially dangerous to Italian savings? It's because any other time anybody's toyed with getting out of the euro, Germany stomped on them.
Mm-hmm.
So we saw this in we saw this in Greece when they held their referendum. They voted to defy Europe, and the next day the prime minister caved into Germany. Mm-hmm. We saw this in Italy, even where in 2011 Italy's prime minister was deliberately forced out by France and Germany. France and Germany got together with the European Central Bank. They said, we're going to manipulate the bond market. We're going to manipulate the interest rate that Italy pays on its debts because we want to get rid of a prime minister. And we're not going to stop manipulating it until Silvio Berlusconi is gone. And that's what happened. And a European official basically was parachuted in, Mario Monti, to be the next prime minister. So you saw something very similar happening again.
Right.
That was Tuesday.
Yeah, this was just, I guess you had an article on the website just a couple of days ago saying this was a real demonstration of just how much power Germany has, the fact that Italy would make this move, that the Italian president would essentially remove this individual because of something that would be ideologically different than what Germany wants. And yet, here we are 2 days later, the prime minister is put in place. So what happened in the interim?
Right. So what I said in that article is kind of like, well, Germany's won this battle, but they've not won the war. There's a whole lot more to play out. They have stopped this government for now, but they've still got lots of levers. So what they did is they came up with what seems like a pretty small compromise, really. So the Italian, the proposed coalition, at first they said, well, that's it. We're going to go for fresh elections. We won't support this. Then they said, OK, well, what if we don't give Savona, this guy you don't like, we won't give him the finance ministry. We'll give him the Europe, like basically like a minister for Europe. It's a much more low profile job. And we'll give the finance minister to another guy, Giovanni Tria. And Tria, you look at what he said, and basically he seems to pretty much be on the same page as Savona. And it seems like he agrees with Savona in general. But he's not been quite as outspoken in the same way.
Another story that we covered on our June 1st program was the military alignment of Russia and China continuing to advance. This story was brought to us by Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, officials from the militaries of Russia and China met in Beijing on Wednesday, and they set some plans in motion to deepen their military ties and also just to lift their military partnership up to what they called a new stage of cooperation. I'll just read a little bit from the official statement that was issued after these high-level talks. This statement said, quote, "The two sides reached broad consensus on current international and regional hotspot issues, and on further deepening Russia-China military cooperation. The two sides will firmly implement the important consensus reached by President Xi Jinping and President Putin, further enhance the level of bilateral military cooperation, and make positive efforts to help the strategic cooperation between the two militaries to take new steps in the new stage." So these are some bold statements and some really ambitious plans that they've laid out there. And really, this is just a continuation of efforts that we've seen over at least the last 15 years or so for Russia and China to increase their military might and combine their military might together. These are, you know, these nations have the world's second and third most powerful militaries. So the fact that they're working now to pool them together just has some really significant implications.
How much of this do you see as a direct opposition to the United States?
Quite a lot of it. They both feel encircled by the U.S. in a way, or at least they claim that they feel encircled. You know, the South China Sea there, the U.S. has been conducting more freedom of navigation operations through there, which just infuriates China. They claim that as their own territory. And then in Poland, you've got the Polish suddenly saying, we want to establish a permanent United States military base here, just to make sure that Russia can't invade us. And on a number of issues such as those, both Russia and China feel that they want to be able to keep the United States out of their backyards.
Mm-hmm. And a related story this week, Russia delivering fighter jets to China.
Right. Yes, this was on Tuesday that Russia announced that they'll be delivering 10 more of their Su-35 fighter jets to China's Air Force by the end of this year. So in 2016 and 2017, we saw Russia already deliver 14 of these very advanced $100 million jets to China's People's Liberation Army Air Force. So this latest delivery announced this week will bring the total number up to 24. And, you know, numerous nations have tried to buy these advanced aircraft from Russia, but so far China is the only one to receive delivery of them. And only one other nation has even been able to finalize a contract, and that's Indonesia. So this weapons deal between Russia and China just, you know, it provides concrete evidence of the high level of trust and cooperation between these two nations.
We're seeing a lot of deals, economic and military, among Asian nations. But really, the relationship between Russia and China seems uniquely strong, and it seems like, especially militarily, it's just routine that we're hearing these kinds of headlines.
Yes, that's right. Since 2005, Russia and China have had dozens of joint military drills together, major drills, including a set right there in the Mediterranean Sea, which, you know, that's Europe's sort of their backyard there. And then in the Sea of Japan, they conducted major drills. It's so routine now that they hardly ever even get a whole lot of attention in the Western press. But these two both are revisionist powers. They want to bring an end to the area, to this era of U.S. dominance, mm-hmm. and to this kind of unipolar world. And so they have a lot to cooperate over.
Yeah. So Russia and China in prophecy, that's a booklet that we've offered for a long time. Watching these two powers in particular align the way that they are, quite significant as far as we're concerned.
Very significant, yes. For over half a century, The Trumpet and our predecessor magazine, The Plain Truth, have been expecting Russia and China to partner up, and that's because Bible prophecy says in the end time, a Russia-China axis will lead a massive military bloc that ends up fielding an army larger than any the world has ever seen before. And the scriptures show that this bloc will play a major role in a nuclear World War III. And right now, when we see these two militaries of Russia and China coming closer and closer together, making major weapons deals, we really should see that as setting the stage for the next and final world war.
Mm-hmm. A big story from Turkey. When the nation held elections in June and their people awarded their president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, broad new executive powers, this was covered on our June 27th program by Brent Noctegal.
Turkish strongman Recep Tayyip Erdogan has likely cemented his control over the nation for the next decade by cruising to victory in Sunday's parliamentary and presidential elections. The victory culminates a 15-year transformation of Turkish politics, overseen and largely orchestrated by Erdogan himself. Now, new executive powers will be transferred to Erdogan as a result of a 2017 change in the constitution that was pushed by Erdogan that made Turkey an executive presidency. Erdogan will be able to rule till 2029. "I have been entrusted by the nation with the tasks and duties of the president," Erdogan said as he claimed victory. According to the chief of Turkey's election authority, Erdogan defeated his closest rival with an absolute majority. He won 52.5% of the vote in the presidential poll. In the parliamentary elections, Erdogan's Justice and Development Party and its coalition partner easily won more than half of the seats. This tandem of parliamentary control combined with the new presidential powers, which include executive power over the judiciary, gives Erdogan unchecked and unmatched power in the modern era of Turkey. However, while many past elections in Turkey witnessed a high level of irregularities, this one seemed to be largely undoctored. Indeed, with 88% turnout in Sunday's election, Erdogan says that, quote, "Turkey has given a lesson in democracy to the entire world," end quote. How is it, then, that the democratic nation of Turkey, with some 80 million people, has wittingly handed dictatorial powers over to Erdogan, confirming him as the first sultan of the modern Turkish era? And what does this say, not just about Erdogan, but rather about the condition of the modern nation of Turkey? First, let's look how we got here. Allahu Akbar. It is necessary to remember that although Turkey is over 95% Muslim, the modern state was created in such a way to ensure a separation between the state and religion. That secularism was a result of the rule of the modern Turkish founder Mustafa Atatürk. Out of the ashes of the Ottoman Empire, Atatürk enacted such laws as banning religious clothing such as the hijab. He put mosques under the state control and even removed Islam from the constitution as the state religion. Since Atatürk's rule ended, there have been numerous attempts to water down Turkey's secular foundation. However, most of those were put down through the timely intervention of the military, which is seen as the vanguard for keeping Turkey secular.
Recep Tayyip Erdogan's first major position came in 1994 when he was made mayor of Istanbul. While at that post, Erdogan's Islamist leanings were clearly visible, going so far as to call himself the Imam of Istanbul. While he did bring a certain amount of prosperity and change to the city, Erdogan started to push back at Ataturk's vision for the state, all the while stating that he was giving the people what they wanted. In 1997, he made his desires a little too overt as he decided to read a religious poem at a rally. This led to his arrest and imprisonment for 4 months. However, after coming out of prison, his popularity only seemed to increase. In 2002, he joined national politics and eventually became prime minister in 2003, leading Turkey throughout the next decade and slowly began blurring the lines between religion and the state. In 2014, he became president of Turkey. He quickly changed the largely ceremonial role of the president and ended up dominating several Turkish prime ministers. It all seemed to be going well for Erdogan. However, all those gains were put in jeopardy on the night of July 15, 2016. That was the evening that Turkish tanks rolled into Istanbul. Soon, the sonic boom of tactical jets and the low thumping of helicopters could be heard flying overhead. A coup d'etat was underway as the military tried to remove Erdogan from power. For a moment, it looked like time might finally be up for President Erdogan's regime. Within hours, though, the effort collapsed. Forces loyal to the president violently repelled the anti-regime soldiers. In the conflict, more than 2,100 people were injured and more than 300 were killed. The military had protected Turkish secularism for more than 50 years. In 1960, 1971, 1980, and 1997, the military had preserved the modern secular democratic state by successfully overthrowing the government. But not this time. Erdogan managed to evade the revolutionaries as they descended on the coastal hotel where he had been staying. He then appeared on CNN Turk, calling on his supporters to take to the streets and use all means necessary to stop the insurrection. The people obeyed, defying the military's imposed curfew. Footage quickly emerged on social media of men in plain clothes trying to hold back battle tanks, some even lying in front of them as they plowed forward. This further motivated Erdogan's supporters to come out in droves. The iconic moment of the coup came the next day. It wasn't the image the military had hoped for, Erdogan in handcuffs. Instead, it was the image of soldiers laying down their weapons in surrender and being marched off the Bosporus Bridge. The military takeover had failed. Worse, though, than just botching the coup, the futile military action gave the president the rationale he needed to remove dissenters from positions of power throughout the nation. And since that time, the Turkish government has shut down 189 media outlets, arrested over 300 journalists, closed more than 3,000 schools, dormitories, and universities, dismissed 4,463 judges and prosecutors, fired 5,822 academics and some 146,000 state officials. Erdogan's men have arrested 77,000 people and detained 136,000 other people. All of these people are accused of having connections to Gulen, an enemy of Erdogan who now lives in exile in Pennsylvania, and who Erdogan blames for the coup attempt in 2016. Thus, Erdogan has gained absolute control over the judiciary and the military, and virtual control over the academia and the press in Turkey. And with all of his opposition out of the way, Erdogan felt strong enough to start changing the Turkish constitution. In a nationwide referendum on April 16, 2017, Turks narrowly voted to pass 18 constitutional amendments that have transformed the nation from a parliamentary democracy into a presidential republic, effectively an executive presidency. And the first election under this new system took place on Sunday. While there was a healthy opposition to Erdogan, it still wasn't enough to dethrone him. Erdogan now has the opportunity to rule for more than the next decade as president, with powers more akin to President Putin of Russia than that of any democracy. Nevertheless, it is an important and often overlooked fact to remember that the people chose him. While not all elections are free and fair in Turkey, and indeed controlling the national press on the lead-up to an election can certainly tilt the scales, the fact remains that a majority of Turks want Erdogan as their leader. This transformation in Turkey is not a rare fluke. As Trumpet magazine editor Joel Hilliker recently wrote, it is part of a trend that is affecting other major nations. For nearly two centuries, democratic free societies led by the British Empire and the United States have flourished, but modern sophisticated, wealthy, and well-armed nations such as Turkey are now reverting to authoritarianism. In Asia, Vladimir Putin is dominating Russia, Xi Jinping is dominating China, Shinzo Abe is reviving militarism and nationalism in Japan, and Rodrigo Duterte is bluntly, unapologetically, and vulgarly scorning the rule of law in the Philippines. In Europe, record numbers of voters are electing nationalists. Viktor Orban in Hungary, Sebastian Kurz in Austria, Andrej Babiš in the Czech Republic. In the Middle East, the flash of optimism during the Arab Spring is over, and the region has emerged even less democratic and free, ruled by autocrats, driven by tribalism and violent turf wars. By several measures, looked at globally, the power of governments and individual leaders is growing, and the freedoms of the people are eroding. People are recognizing that the world is getting more aggressive and more dangerous. People are looking for security and protection, and strong men are promising to provide it. In Turkey, that man is Recep Tayyip Erdogan, and he now has more power than any Turkish leader has since the fall of the Ottoman Empire.
Güvenli evlerine dönüş yollarını açmaya devam edeceğimizin ifadesidir.
Political change was also coming in the United States. July brought a stunning result in a Democratic primary in New York, and the chair of the National Party, the Democrat Party, said, "You're looking at the future of the party." We covered this on our July 6th program by Andrew Miller.
Yeah, the Democratic Party in the United States has just undergone an astounding transformation in the past three decades, where if you go look back to like 1992, Bill Clinton was campaigning on a platform quite similar to Donald Trump's. Then 2008, Barack Obama was campaigning on a platform that had some very socialistic undertones to it, even though in his rhetoric he consistently denied any connections to socialism or the far left. And now you have an increasing number of leaders in the Democratic Party who are openly and proudly embracing the democratic socialist label. Bernie Sanders kind of broke the ice with that in the last presidential campaign, but in actually what analysts are calling one of the biggest upsets in modern American political history, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, a self-described democratic socialist, beat a 10-term incumbent senator in a New York congressional primary. This was a very Joe Crowley was a very like democratic establishment senator, was lost his term to this new democratic socialist, a 28-year-old who's come in on a platform for free health care, free college tuition, completely abolish the ICE agency, the Immigration and Border Control Agency, and replace it with nothing. I guess just take it back to state-level immigration control or nothing.
Wow.
And then this is easy to look at this as maybe just like one district in New York, but then the election happened next month, but even just this past Tuesday, the chairman of the Democratic National Committee, Tom Perez, wholeheartedly embraced Ocasio-Cortez, even calling her the future of the Democratic Party. He said, "I have three kids, two of whom are daughters. One just graduated college. One is still in college. They're both texting me about their excitement over Alexandria because she represents the future of our party." And he's saying that this is the direction as chairman of the Democratic Party that he wants to take the party more towards the Ocasio-Cortez, Bernie Sanders wing of the party, just openly embracing the democratic socialist policies. In the case of Ocasio-Cortez, she's actually also a member of the Democratic Socialist of America. That's a party founded back in 1980 as an offshoot of the Socialist Party USA, which only had 5,000 members till Donald Trump was elected, and then since then has had its membership really balloon out to approaching 50,000 members now. So Trump's election's actually been great for the Democratic Socialist of America. They've increased their membership tenfold and taken a much more radical stance, because this is an organization Ocasio-Cortez is part of. And when they were founded in 1980, they were very vocal that they wanted a softer socialism. They didn't want the full-on communism. They wanted democratic socialism. Although now, just in the past week or so, there's been a half a dozen leaders in the Democratic Socialist of America tweeting a hashtag communism is good. And even at the college level, some of the leaders of the college student organizations openly calling for the assassination of President Donald Trump or the massacre of Republican officials.
An important trend we follow at the Trumpet is Iran's efforts to control the Middle East, particularly the oil shipping routes through the Red Sea. In July, Iran made a provocative attack highlighting this trend. We heard about this on our July 27th program from Brent Noctegal.
Yeah, there were two massive tankers that belonged to Aramco, the Saudi Arabian state-owned oil company, that were targeted by the Iranian-backed Houthis just north of the Bab el-Mandeb Strait. This is the 18-mile choke point of all sea transit coming from the Indian Ocean into the Red Sea that goes up into the Suez Canal and into the Mediterranean. And so the ships themselves only suffered minor damage. But the big story isn't the fact that they were targeted. The big story is the fact that Saudi Arabia has decided that it is no longer going to ship oil through the Bab el-Mandeb Strait at least they're putting a temporary hold on that, which is just stunning. The Kuwaiti government they haven't decided yet what they're going to do with their tankers, but they have released a statement saying that they are looking at the situation as well. So they might cancel their oil transit through the Red Sea as well. And so this is a very important development, something that we've been watching for a long, long time, or at least a few years, just because we've talked about Iran and their support of the Houthis and how the reason that they were supporting the Houthis wasn't just to try and be the thorn in Saudi Arabia's side with somebody just south of the border of Saudi Arabia that could fire missiles into Saudi Arabia. The whole reason they're supporting them was so that Iran can govern this important sea choke point. And right now we've seen the first effects of that. Saudi Arabia is deciding no longer their super tank is going to come through here.
We'll finish with one last story. One of the biggest of the past couple of years has been the migrant crisis in Europe. This has been driving radical political changes in European countries. Well, just this August, there was a strong example of this after the murder in East Germany by a migrant sparked major riots by anti-immigrant and neo-Nazi Germans. We heard about this on our August 31st program from Richard Palmer.
Let me just start by reading you some headlines from or about the events in Germany this week, because they really are dramatic and chilling. Germany's far-right groups are on the march. That was from the Times yesterday. Pogrom mood sweeps Germany over migrants. That was from the Times today. German author Thilo Sarrazin is fueling fear of Muslims. This from France 24. German far-right stages new anti-Merkel protest in Chemnitz. German police suspected of collaborating with neo-Nazis. That's another one. So really some dramatic events coming from Germany just this week. So what happened was this all got started on Sunday. In the early hours of Sunday morning, a man was stabbed in this town of Chemnitz in Germany, East Germany, not too far from Dresden. And we've been hearing more and more about what happened on Sunday morning throughout the week. The picture that we have now is that he was stabbed by a migrant that came over in 2015. This migrant had been arrested before on various different offenses, many of them drug-related. He had then somehow not been deported. He was still out there on the streets, and he killed this guy. So then Sunday, we didn't know that all of that at the start of the week. There was just this rumor began spreading that this individual was stabbed by a migrant. Sunday night, you had these protests as far-right individuals came out there and rioted or attacked migrants, shouted anti-migrant slogans, and the police just lost control completely. They weren't at all expecting this. They even on that night, I think they had to call in support from Leipzig and Dresden, these much larger cities nearby. And so then the next night, there were more protests, much bigger protests. And once again, the police completely, they lost control. They had water cannon, but they just couldn't get control. It seems there are about 5,000 or 6,000 demonstrators, many of them doing Hitler salutes, shouting things like "foreigners out, up Deutschland," and nationalist slogans and anti-migrant slogans, physically attacking migrants and police in some cases, throwing bottles, throwing fireworks. You also had about 1,000 people on the left in a counter demonstration, and you had this outbreak of violence on the streets of a German town. German press, some German newspapers referred to it as a civil war on the streets of Chemnitz. It was the largest neo-Nazi rally since 1992. So it was a dramatic moment for Germany, and the German press has obviously focused a lot on this, with politicians and media all having something to say. But it was just the biggest far-right explosion that we've had in years, and it comes directly as a result of the migrant crisis.
I'm Joel Hilliker, and that will do it for today's Trumpet Hour, this year in review that we've been taking these last couple of weeks. We hope you enjoyed it. You can email us your thoughts on the program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal. Thanks to our staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with the words of Theodore Roosevelt: in any moment of decision, the best thing you can do is the right thing, the next best thing is the wrong thing, and the worst thing you can do is nothing. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.